So that strap, I mean, you can go ahead and try to, like, move the deadbolt thumb turn.
Sure.
That
ain't going anywhere.
But in the event of a fire, you can just rip that off really fast.
That's true.
So again, it's giving people tools that reduce their level of friction. I want to give solutions that are easy that become barriers that are really hard.
Welcome to All in a Day's Sex Work. I'm your host, Blair Hopkins. On this show, we've talked a lot about the disastrous and often tragic outcomes associated with how sex work, particularly full-service sex work, is stigmatized and criminalized. For the most part, when we've gone into this subject matter, it's been to highlight either the systemic causes angle, i.e. how criminalization makes sex work more dangerous, or from the perspective of people who've been victimized, i.e. how violent predators make sex work more dangerous. Today, I'd like to share a different angle. I had a wonderful conversation about prevention and risk mitigation. Deviant Olaf is a hacker. He's a renowned lockpick in both the digital and physical realms. He's authored two books, Practical Lockpicking and Keys to the Kingdom, and conducts security training for organizations worldwide. There's a lot of overlap between hackers and sex workers. For one thing, Deviant refers to himself as a, quote, physical penetration specialist, which I'm sure some of you also do, and if you don't, perhaps you should. Also, the demographics share obstacles regarding constant misrepresentation and the threat of reactionary government and prosecutorial overreach. Deviant, noticing these areas of shared threat and interest alike, began freely offering his expertise in physical and digital security basics training to sex workers. Now, I want to be clear here. We should not have to know this stuff. I fully subscribe to the idea that everyone should be able to be naked all the time with their doors unlocked. Stalkers, rapists, and abusers of all stripes should be able to be reported to trustworthy law enforcement officers and handled swiftly and appropriately within the context of a recovery and restorative justice-centric system. Alas, that is not the world in which we live, right? So, for me personally, I find it really comforting to be walked through my areas of oversight and ignorance. The sense of control and empowerment that comes from knowing something about the world that I did not know before is incredibly valuable to me and to many others. As Deviant walked me through what he calls his street-to-suite security assessment for hotels, at first I was floored and impressed by all the cool information and gadgets he had to share. Then I was horrified by the implications of this knowledge and what it can do in the wrong hands. Finally, I was delighted to be included in possession of this knowledge. Also, he gave us all a pro tip on password creation, like, seriously so simple, but completely blew my mind. I think you'll feel similarly.
So, those who know me, my name is Deviant Olaf. I am findable out there on that internet sometimes. I show up in odd places. I'm not really known for anything other than being the equivalent of like an actor who shows up on all the TV shows like, hey, it's that guy. What's he doing on that channel? Oh, how's that? He's talking at that conference. I've seen that guy. Mostly, I guess people think of me as a physical security and covert entry person, although I don't like to be defined by how I make money, but that is my job. It is a cool job. Like, I get to break into buildings and tell people how secure their building is. But in terms of the connection to the hacker community, the sex work community, these are just really long-standing ties that I've had for a very long time. The moniker Deviant basically stands for the fact that to deviate doesn't mean to be bad, right? It just means to do something not in the normal way. And there's always been a special place in my heart for anyone who is on the fringes, on the edges, doing things not the normal way, because they're probably not a bad person. They're just different than you, and they deserve extra time and consideration when you first meet them.
Tell me more about your long-standing ties to the sex worker community.
Sure. So Both my wife and I have been very adjacent to a lot of people in sex work in the broadest sense. I mean, we've known people who are dancers, we've known people in film performance, but honestly, even in terms of full service sex work, there have been a number of people since I was pretty much in my mid-20s who were in that part of the trade. And kind of a thing I like to say to a lot of folk is everyone out there knows sex workers. You just might not realize you know sex workers. It's a little bit of not exactly a pleasant analogy, but when Me Too started happening, there was this conversation around like, no, every woman in your world has experienced harassment and assault. They're just maybe not telling you about it. Not because they haven't experienced it, you're just putting off the vibe that you're not a person they can tell. So for whatever reason, I have, I guess, put off a vibe that I am a person who's approachable, and people who have done a lot of work all across the spectrum in the sex work industry have just talked to me about it over the years. And I've maintained close connections and ties with them for a long time. It really started to click for me, the connections that communities have, though, when I started following Maggie a lot more. I read her blog is prolific. And of course, whenever we talk sex work, you and I were talking about this. When we say Maggie, but you'd be like, no, well, Seattle Maggie. Well, no, the other Seattle
Maggie.
Maggie. I call her Mags. So Maggie McNeil. Yeah. So when Mags' blog was out, and I would follow her on Twitter, mostly, honestly, through E&B, Liz Brown, who I knew just from being on the East Coast and journalism and in that sort of space of liberty and freedom movements. So I met Mags through E&B, and then I kept reading things that she would put out about struggles that the whole sex work community would face. And I'm like, Christ, this is such a parallel to everything in my, when I say my community, meaning the hacker community, where you have sort of a misunderstood group of people who are easily othered by, you know, in quotes, like respectable society. And that makes them both a boogeyman and a punching bag. It makes this group of people super targeted by new laws, which anyone can just wave some magic pixie dust and say, oh, we have to fight this scourge. Meanwhile, the laws are written without consulting anyone in that industry. And it only results in more clenching grip of power on mostly black and brown and poor people. So anytime a congressperson stands up and says, we have to stop the hacking, they're really not consulting experts in the security world. They just want to, I don't know, posture against foreign powers, Russia, China, and then lock up some black and brown kids.
Yeah. Unless you're the current Republican Party, in which case apparently you don't give a fuck about cybersecurity.
Exactly. And the same thing with the sex work world. I mean, most legislation is approached by talking to NGOs and groups who don't have any real connection. They have ulterior motives and they just want power and funds. And then it ends up being this for the children that turns into just cracking down on a bunch of defenseless people. So that's what inspired a blog post I wrote a while back saying to all the hackers in my community, look, we need to be going to more sex work related events and telling a lot of the sex workers that it, like, look, tech savvy people have answers to questions you may have. Come to our events. And seeing some of that crossover has been great. Seeing Maggie Mayhem, San Francisco Maggie, seeing Maggie Mayhem come to, I mean, she's spoken at Hope. She's spoken at DEF CON. She and her husband, like, they're just the sweetest people ever. And bridging those gaps in our two worlds is really important because we can lift each other up.
I mean, do you vend to or advise to sex workers about things like cyber and physical security? What does that look like?
Yeah, not so much vending. I don't believe in monetizing all elements of service among friends. I don't flip it the other way. I think sex workers should always charge for their time because literally their time is their money. My knowledge is something that I feel it's more important to get the knowledge out to marginalized groups. It's the same way I wouldn't charge money when I've worked with domestic abuse, you know, victims. I'm like, all right, let's get your phone cleaned up. Let's figure out, is your ex, you know, do they still have the keys? Do they not have the keys? But I do try to speak at any events that I can. I mean, I sat with Alex at the table at Woodhull, just working kind of the swap behind bars table, but I was sitting there and I'm like, oh my God, I need to write a talk. I have this whole presentation called From Street to Suite, which is if you are sort of up in a nice apartment on a high floor, what are all the layers of protection between you and someone down at the curbside who would want to get to where you are? And I just step people through, well, this is how the door might be vulnerable. This is how the elevator might be vulnerable. This is how your hallway camera, this is how your latches, bop, 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 bop. And I was literally sitting there selling t-shirts and stickers while I was making these slides, taking footage at the hotel in DC and putting them into the slides, like breaking into my own hotel room and saying, this is how hotel security can be undermined. I mean, we've got this long metal rod here on the table between us. This will open basically every hotel door you'd ever come across.
Really? How?
That is something called an under door tool. If you could imagine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anytime you are inside of a room, well, for code, for NFPA fire code, for ADA compliance, getting out of that room, you need to be able to get out quickly. You can't have thumb turns and bolts and things. I mean, you hit that handle, every hotel you've been in modern days, that door opens. This is a tool that literally reaches under a door, so I can reach up from the outside of the door, I can reach up to the inside handle and pull down, and I can just whack the inside handle from the exterior. Yeah, we can do it later. We can do it on these doors here.
That is freaky. Is that something, I mean, it would be pretty hard to be using that in any kind of covert way. I mean, you'd have to be pretty daring to go into a Marriott or whatever.
You can collapse it up, slip it in a backpack, and then spring it out pretty quickly.
Sure.
We've done it. We've done it in corporate offices when people, you're just, all right, no one's down the hall there. No one's down the hall there. Let's go for the CEO's room and see what we find.
Also, if you're, you know, if you carry yourself, you know, there's something I read somewhere that's just like, you know, the best way to succeed is to just act like you own the place.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So if you go in there with a certain amount of bravado and you really are believing the role, like, even somebody coming upon you would just be like, oh, clearly he's supposed to be breaking into that room.
You put two people together with somewhat matching polo shirts, you know, kind of a dirty tool belt, one person with a clipboard while they're doing something. And if you worry, you know, let's say you're trying to get in someone's room, what if they're in there? I will present you this little sucker. That is a peephole reverser.
Ah.
You can try this later on the back door there by the porch. Like, you can look through a peephole and see nothing, fuzziness. You put that up to the door, you will see the entire room crisp and clear.
Oh, crazy.
And these are all, the reason I like talking about this now, this is all knowledge we've had for a while in the covert entry world. And locksmiths and other industry trade specialists have sort of known this, but for the most part, it wasn't public knowledge. The internet has democratized knowledge in an amazing way, in a way that I very much approve of. But coming with that territory means that secret knowledge is no longer secret. And it's, I almost compare it to the rise of the middle class, sort of in the interwar years and as the aristocracy and everything that world history did. And all of a sudden we have this middle class and they're a whole new type of consumer and money, like person with money. And they changed the whole landscape of economics and what consumerism was. YouTube and the internet has made this middle ground of ruffian, of nefarious person. It used to be if someone was imperiled, let's say by a dangerous ex, that person was either kind of a nobody, like, man, if Billy comes around here, just make sure you tell him I'm not home. He works down at the muffler shop. And this person might be a physical risk, but they really couldn't break into places. Or the other end of that was like, Sally's ex-husband's a cop, he's dangerous. Or Frank used to be a locksmith, or he used to install alarms. Like, that guy's bad news. Now I gotta move or something. And you get really scared. But those are the two extremes. Now there's this middle ground where, like, you went on a few dates with Harry, he kind of sucked, and you don't want to see him again, and you blocked his number. But, like, Harry's been on YouTube, and maybe he's a guy who has looked up a lot of this stuff that's not really, he's never going to be a practicing covert entry tradesman, but that guy can figure out an under door tool. That guy can figure out how to slip a latch on a door if your door is just kind of installed a little janky. These middle of the road dummy attacks are now becoming democratized.
Yeah, now he has the ability to mask his number and call you, inundate you with calls from, like, you know, a million different numbers, no matter how many you block, because all you got to do is search how to mask number or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, Pete the Creep is no longer just someone who can't reach you, because Pete's going to go on the internet and learn a lot of things that used to be the purview of only advanced people who didn't share that knowledge publicly.
So let's talk about hotels. I think a lot of sex workers, that's kind of their primary place of business.
Yep.
Can you walk me through vulnerabilities from the time you get to a hotel to your room?
Sure thing. So right off the hop, Working in a, quote, nicer hotel sometimes brings exposure that some people don't like to attract for themselves, but there is a comfort level of, oh, this hotel needs key cards. This hotel has lobby staff. This hotel requires my room key in the elevator. Let's assume someone is comfortable with that level of hotel because they want that protection. Well, right off the jump, the front doors. Most doors in a hotel, if you need your room key to, like, get in, let's say it's late in the evening, a lot of hotels are like this. Now you need to present your room key. It's after 10 p.m. Well, if you think that the last time you were in a hotel like that, you didn't need your room key to leave, right? When you leave a hotel like that, it's 10:30, you want to get a snack, you're going to go out to the local whatever, quick stop. What is it like leaving the hotel? What happens when you walk out the front lobby?
Nothing. You just leave.
Well, do you have to push on the doors usually?
No.
What happens usually?
You step on a mat. And they automatically open.
Sometimes it's a mat, but more and more today, it's an infrared beam. It's a motion sensor up in the ceiling. So that motion sensor on the inside unlocks the door. It opens the door. Well, if I come up to the hotel and it's 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and I don't have a room key, but I look and it's a big glass frontage, I say, okay, well, there's clearly a motion sensor. And I go ahead and what am I holding here?
That is a dust destroyer, just a standard issue one that you can get to clean your keyboard or whatever. Yeah.
So if I stick this through the, like, right to the gap of the door, and I just kind of do that. Have you ever flipped one of these cans over and sprayed it around?
No.
Tell me how it feels. Put your hand out there.
Damp.
And cold.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to set off the motion sensor on the inside of the door. The doors will spring right open.
If you do it through the
crack in the crack. Door. Yeah. It also has bitterant in it. Sorry for that smell. That'll dissipate in a second.
Huh.
To prevent kids from playing around with it.
Well, I can't.
But,
I was going to say, do I want to cop to having ever turned one of those upside down before? No.
Yeah. So, like, right there, your front door that is key controlled, you know, all of a sudden is not. Mm-hmm. Because of, I mean, what does this cost? $5 at Staples?
Yeah.
All right. So now I'm in the lobby. Maybe someone's in the lobby. Maybe they're not. But honestly, If they even walk away from their desk for a second, I bop the door. Okay, now I'm in the lobby. I'm walking around. Well, I can get to the elevators. Maybe the elevators also require a room key to get up to any floor. Well, if I know the floor I'm going to and I say, I'm going to try to get up to this elevator. Again, these are not just dummy level attacks, but this is on the internet. This knowledge is out there. I'm going to pull apart this little bag here. And I have dumped out a whole bunch of keys.
Mm-hmm.
Now, no one in the internet needs every one of these keys. This is an exceptionally large collection, right?
Sure.
But these are all keys to elevators. Every elevator, by default, is keyed alike from the factory. So if I walk into that elevator and I say, oh, okay, I can't get up to the 7th floor. It needs a room key. Well, this is an Otis elevator. Okay, well, let me peel through my Otis keys here. Let me see, UTA, UTC. Okay, there we go. So these three little keys, these are Otis keys. That will override most Otis elevators and just let me go to any floor I want. Now, normally only an industry technician would have those keys. But again, they're talked about in just 13-year-old kids' YouTube videos now because this knowledge started to leak. Right? I've tried to stay just a little after the curve. There's a lot in our industry that we hold close to the vest. But once it starts leaking out, the only real responsible thing that a lot of folk, at least like me, feel it's appropriate is to then say, all right, we got to get in front of this now. Like, I wasn't going to tell you this. We've been doing this for years, and I'm burning myself with some customers here, but people are now selling these keys on eBay, right? Let's tell as many good people as we can about it so they know that all of a sudden this elevator that you thought would protect you from people coming upstairs, that's not doing anything. I tell people, think of an elevator mostly like an open stairwell in a building. So now this person is up on your floor, let's say. Maybe it's literally a person who visited someone earlier, and now they're coming back later because they have a desire to come back unannounced. So now they're up on the floor. All right, well, they go up to the door. We've talked about the little peephole reverser, which is going to blow your mind when you try that. And they look in there, and they say, okay, this person's not in. Or maybe they are in, which is even more horrible. So they take out their underdoor tool. Okay, well, they've got an under door tool. They're going to reach under the door, try to pull that handle. Now, if you're staying in a hotel room, I imagine you are probably like me in that you don't just close the door and walk away from it. What kind of things do you do to your door?
I do the little, what do you call it? The latch?
The night latch.
Mm-hmm.
So this is called a lock jockey. And if you can get the door just a hair open, you can even imagine the two prongs, the little forks of the night latch. This slides through the door. And then if you actually bounce the door into this, it'll spring the night latch. It'll whack it right open. And then you just burst right through the door. If you're in a different, let's say we're not talking about someone who's in a hotel that has a conventional door. Maybe this is a building where it's, there's, maybe you're on the back side. Maybe there's like a pool entrance and such on the back. And there's large double doors, right, that open for the daytime and close for the nighttime. You might picture large double doors that swing shut. And then it's very typical, okay, we're done with the pool for the day. A big thumb turn goes kind of ka-chunk, ka-chunk. All right, we've locked that up. Well, this tool exists. Firefighters have used this forever, and I teach a lot of first responders. This is called a J-tool. And the J-tool is designed to slide through a double door, find the thumb turn, and then from the outside, I can manipulate that thumb turn just like this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you'd have to be pretty competent with those tools in order to enact them, especially if somebody's in a room. But if somebody is in a room, there's not really a whole lot of anywhere they can go.
Yeah, it's all relative.
It's like if you're sitting on your bed and you mm-hmm. notice somebody pop one of these under your door, you're going to start freaking out. But what do you do? You know?
Right. I mean, ideally, just grab it. Grab anything.
Right.
But you don't know what that person's about to do. You don't know if you're then signaling that you're present. So it's a very insidious situation. Frankly, the thing that I love, because it's not all gloom and doom here, this little blue strap. I don't make any of these tools. I'm not, promoting anything here, my business or otherwise. But this little blue strap, this dumb little blue strap, it's nylon with heavy Velcro on it.
Mm-hmm.
This, and I'll show you in some footage here, it's designed to hook over a thumb turn on the inside. And then there's always some kind of wrapping geometry that you can make to get this to lock onto itself and prevent the thumb turn from moving. So even if someone comes into that room with an underdoor tool or they try to, even if they're literally security is outside the hotel room door with a key and they're reefing on that key trying to get the door unlocked, if that is strapped around the interior thumb turn handle, like that door ain't going anywhere. That door's not opening. So I keep that crumpled up in my carry-on at all times. And whenever I'm in a hotel, whether it's a really posh Vegas hotel on the strip, or whether I'm literally in some seedy compound overseas in the sandbox, I will put that on the door on the inside so I can get a solid 8 hours down knowing that no one's coming in this room while I'm asleep.
Do you find that your knowledge of security and its various vulnerabilities has made it hard for you to get that 8 hours down?
Yes and no. I find it just makes life more interesting. Mostly it's when I'm out and about on the street. You're just pointing at stuff. You're like, oh, look at that. Oh, look at that thing. Oh, look at this over here. Something that's the tool that's closest to you. It's a little assortment of keys that are sort of in a strapped black band. Those are all common keys for what are called access intercoms or telephony intercoms. If you walk up to someone's building and there's a gray box about the size of two shoeboxes, and you have to dial through the directory. And, most of those boxes are all keyed alike from the manufacturer. And I have footage in the presentations that I give of like, well, that's great that you have this multi-$1,000 system that calls people and they have to buzz you in, but that's like a set of $8 keys. And if I just open the panel, I can usually just boop, press a button and unlock a door and walk in an apartment complex or walk in a gated community. And I want to keep reiterating, none of this is a sky is falling, everyone needs to panic moment. I believe that knowledge empowers people. And that's why I like to share this. Yes, it makes people like, oh, Christ, one more thing I got to think about in my life. But the defenses against a lot of these attacks are so low effort. Like, the attacks are scary because they're low effort. The defenses are even more low effort. And you can stymie that, CD Pete guy who's watched his stuff on YouTube. If you take, let's say Pete has spent 20 hours on YouTube learning all these crazy skills. Well, you could take maybe 20 minutes to kind of change the screw here, tighten up a little thing there, adjust one thing, put a blue strap on your door. Those 20 minutes will completely exhaust all of Sneaky Pete's tactics that he was going to try.
What are some situations that you have seen specifically with the sex workers that you know? Like, what have they come to you with?
So most sex workers contact us, mostly my wife especially, because she's much more famous than I am in this space. Most concerns are digital these days. either because people are worried about, is my communication secure? What if my device gets taken from me? Those are the real, and those, let's be honest, are the greater threat model. Frankly, it is easier to harass or to try to investigate someone digitally than it is to you know, get out there and pound pavement. So most nefarious people, whether they are state actors or non-state actors, are doing their attacks digitally. And that's really where, it's nothing wrong with devoting a lot of resources into that space. And this is the same thing that a lot of people do with women who are in, not even in the sex trade, and not all sex workers are women, I realize, but anyone who's just in abusive relationships. It's frankly, I mean, sex workers are in an abusive relationship with society, in a sense. So there's anything we would advise someone who's a battered woman, we would advise the sex work community. This is how you lock your phone. This is how you, you know, don't use that email, use this email service. Use, you know, we recommend things like Proton Mail. We recommend you and I are messaging over Signal. And the more, it's, I'm very proud of how that project has grown. Oh my gosh. Moxie Marlin Spike is an old friend of ours. And I remember when Signal was, wasn't even called Signal, it was called Red Phone. And seeing that project really become, again, just accessible and democratized. The internet may have democratized sneaky learning, but it's also democratized encryption. It's democratized security consciousness. And the there was the old movie. Who was that movie with Will Smith and John Voight? God. We'll edit this pause.
I stopped paying attention to John Voight after he became a Trump supporter.
Yeah. Enemy of the State, I think.
Yes.
You know, he has this grumpy line. He's this NSA guy. He's like, you think the world's a good place out there? 13-year-olds can go on the internet, download encryption that we can barely break. And all of us in the hacker world are like, yes, that's how it's supposed to work. Like,
that's why you should stop convicting them of crimes and start hiring them.
Yes, yeah. Anyone should be able to have encryption that no one can break. Like, having the ability to lock your shit up.
Well, that's good. Funny to me, like, how the tides have kind of changed on that, or how progress has been made. Because, like, on the one hand, if you ask anyone who a hacker is, they're going to give you, like, the 1995 hackers version of what a hacker is. Or they're going to, like, envision something out of Minority Report, you know, some crazy. At the same time, there's a podcast that I listened to where they have an ad. This is a major, major podcast production company that has a VPN ad in their regular ads. And they will talk openly about, in this ad copy, about, like, you can now watch whatever you want on Netflix in Mexico or whatever. And you're like,
oh, yeah.
There's quite the disconnect there, I think, between what we think of as hackers and what hacking actually, like, does and means, and what, like, the actual, like, practical applications are in your day-to-day life. What would you say are some of the misconceptions that people have about their digital security?
People either worry too much or too little. In a sense, worrying about the wrong things. So you'll have someone saying, and this is much more a gripe in the hacker world, right? Someone will say, that password you're using isn't strong enough. It needs to be 29 characters, not 14. You know, you need to have all these exclamation points and symbol. Like, no, that's all BS. Let me just tell you, and I'm going to get yelled at by all my hacker friends. If your password is over 12, 13 characters, I don't care if it has capitals in it and numbers and symbols. Just make it long and memorable. Because here's the thing, when we tell people to use these crazy outlandish passwords, no one wants to remember that. So what do? They write it down. And then if you have, you know, someone bursts into your room and seizes your phone and they can't break it because Apple and other people have done a great job with iPhone encryption. But if you have this crazy password that you need to write down, well, I mean, you're going to get your stuff rummaged through. If there's a notebook in there with a password, guess what? That long, crazy, complex password now isn't doing you a whole lot of good.
What about password managers?
Love them. Absolutely love them. And in fact, this is kind of a, if you ever do worry that you will forget your big master password, which, again, when you're talking about password managers, you're talking about 1Password, KeePass, LastPass. They're all very good solutions. My wife and I use a number of them for different businesses and personal things. If you are really, truly worried about losing your top master password, here's what you could do. I'm going to just walk over to my bookshelf, and I'm taking a book at random. All right. So pick any book that you would carry with you at all times. It could be your favorite book, whatnot. You know how they say never use your birth date as a password? Go ahead and do this. If you were born on, like, you know, January 15th, okay, literally turn to a page that would be your birth date and pick the first complete sentence on that page. Don't put a star in the column. Don't dog-ear the thing. Just remember, my birth date in this book. You could literally lose this book in a fire. And Amazon for the copy of the book, so you always have a copy of that book. And then that one sentence, that one long sentence, is your top master password. And it's something that no one could ever determine, but you could always reconstruct if you had to.
I know that passwords are like, I mean, it's the bane of everybody's online existence.
So there's a lot of bad infighting among both hackers and outsiders about things like biometrics on your phone. And they're thinking that, I guess, again, it comes down to thinking that there is one right answer in all situations is the big problem. So let's talk about my phone is in my pocket. My phone is going to unlock right now with my fingerprint because it's convenient, A, and it's better than having no lock on it at all. But we can also think, someone said, you don't want to do that. You should type your password every time. They can, and this is true. Everyone should know. Police can compel people to use a fingerprint. Police can try to compel people to use face unlock. There's actually pretty scary footage out of New York of, I don't know if it was New York NYPD. It was some housing authority, police.
I mean,
something.
Whatever you're about to say seems like something the NYPD would do.
There's a
I feel
guy,
like I can say that preemptively.
There's a guy, he's clearly in restraints. He's sitting on a bench and it's footage from like a hallway camera. It's not great, but you see them bring the phone to his face. And he starts bobbing and weaving like a guy in a boxing match. And they're trying to get the phone to unlock. And good on him, he kept moving around and the phone would not unlock. Because it has to be a proper standstill, look at my phone. But those kind of things, like, yes, authorities or even non-state actors. If someone is, I guess, mugging you and has command of you and your hands and your face. I mean, someone can force you to use biometrics in the way they can't force you to use a password, at least not legally. You can't legally be compelled to use a password. So someone might say, look, Deviant's an idiot. Why is he using biometrics on his phone? Well, we also have cameras all over the frickin' place nowadays. And most of the places I go in society have cameras all over my head. If I'm in an airport, I mean, I'm flying all the time, I'm traveling all the time. Most folk know that. I'm much happier being able to use my fingerprint in those environments than typing out a password on my phone, potentially on camera every time. Being able, and what I ultimately do if I'm crossing a security checkpoint, like, yes, my phone just kind of, you know, unlocks. Anywhere on my phone, I've configured it that a straight swipe up, just like that, that just killed my fingerprint right there. So I cannot, it'll say, no, please enter password, please enter password. And if I'm walking through it, each time your threat is greater, your posture gets greater. That's if I'm walking through the TSA and I'm going to be separated from my device, right? And there's some cops kind of in the airport. But if I'm walking through a border checkpoint, right, we have no rights at international borders. So, I mean, my phone is hard powered off. And that's what all of us do with all our devices. They are not just in standby or asleep. They are powered off. And yeah, there's a lot of bad knowledge from people who are acting in good faith, but not understanding that everyone's threat model is different.
How much overlap would you say there is between the methods that stalkers use versus the methods that law enforcement or state actors use?
They're becoming very similar. So yeah, that sort of middle ground, that kind of almost YouTube university skill level, we're seeing both the state actors and the non-state actors bleed into that from either direction, where your average stalker, like just shitty Gary stalker, like, well, now Gary's going to go on YouTube and learn some of these skills. And he's kind of lifting himself up to the next tier of attack level. But even police and other state actors, as, I mean, someone you know, the reporter Michael Hobbs, he and Sarah Marshall did a whole special about how crime investigation, we don't do that as a society the way we used to. And that has, those methods have kind of trickled downward into this low-hanging fruit style of investigation, of just kind of internet-based social media point-and-click investigation in a lot of ways. So yeah, this middle ground, if the average person can learn to armor themselves against this middle ground, this low-hanging fruit vulnerability, they're shielding themselves from both authorities and from stalkers at the same time in new ways.
Like, what kind of exists in that middle ground that somebody who's like, We'll say, a middle income full service sex worker mm-hmm. would need to be concerned about from law enforcement or from a stalker like that exists in that middle knowledge base area.
If someone is engaging in any activity that might leave footprints on a phone, if they have the economic wherewithal to have an entirely separate device, that is their work device, that is their non-personal device. I mean, how many people, when they go to jobs, they literally get issued a phone? This is common in corporate America, because keeping your personal stuff separate from your work endeavors, like corporate people have known this for years.
Which is also a good idea just for your mental health. But yeah. That's another conversation.
Having that one device and using a complete device encryption, with which all modern iPhones and Android phones are full device encryption, using a proper long password, and understanding how to turn off that device so that your biometrics are not going to unlock it. That is a huge step in the right direction. I mean, that's literally the advice we give to people when they're like, I do a lot of State Department travel. When you're overseas, like, this is your secure device, you turn it the F off. And even if someone is detaining me, like, unlock this device. If I just say no, call the embassy. There's now, of course, everyone's situation is different. And you and I walk around with our skin will show bruises, as I like to say. We are very white. So if someone is just exercising that right, no, I won't unlock my phone, that could be a very bad day in an extrajudicial or in a corrupt situation. They might literally be facing fists. But a fist can't unlock that phone. A threat can't unlock that phone. Modern smartphones, if you are practicing good hygiene, you're not putting your personal stuff on the phone. You're not tying that phone to your personal email, your personal tweets, your personal anything. If it's just a work device, it is actually monumentally hard for any domestic actor. Honestly, even like huge, I mean, the NYPD has a budget and an investigatory division that rivals the FBI. We can almost use the NYPD as a stand-in for the strongest police department and the damn near government level intrusion. Even they have a backlog of something like, I don't know what it is now, 6,000-7,000 phones that are just sitting there in evidence rooms, just locked. And most of them are just taken off of either like drug cases or just kids they're harassing on the street for whatever reason. But they're just all drug case phones. They're just sitting there and they can't touch them. They have access to the same tools that any government have. They have access to the Israeli suite of tools by Cellbrite, by Zero Dark. I mean, I'm just dropping names that hacker folk will know. And they really can't break into most of these phones because someone has like the latest iPhone that's fully updated and it was found powered off. If that device is powered off when someone steals it, there's almost nothing they can do. And please, all my hacker or sex worker friends who know different, please yell at me on Twitter if I'm wrong and I'm spreading bad information.
That's interesting. You think of and see occasionally there'll be a story that pops up about this, that like Facebook is cooperating with law enforcement or mm-hmm. Apple is cooperating with law enforcement to provide facial recognition or whatever, whatever. But ultimately, these corporations exist. Their technology is super proprietary mm-hmm. and it exists outside the reach of the government to actually kind of maybe an alarming extent, alarming but useful extent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy to me that like they say you should put an ICE number in your phone and specify it as an ICE number, but like a paramedic can't just unlock your iPhone if you're unconscious. Right.
That is true.
So
yeah, if your phone is powered on, there is something called emergency mode that most phones support now. But again, I consider that the traffic accident situation, you weren't expecting to have an encounter with a threat scenario. If you're going through anything that might be dodgy, if someone is in any environment where they're like, I could get my shit fucked with here, literally hard power the phone off, just hard power it off. If someone was meeting with a person for the first time and they don't know if they trust that person. And of course, the double-edged sword is like, you know, you were literally driving to where we were meeting and we're messaging like, no, turn to the right. Okay, I think you're in here. And you're like, so we need our phones to communicate with someone we're meeting with. But when is that moment? Like, is the moment when they're parking their car and you're standing in the parking lot? Like, maybe that's the moment where they clearly have found me, hard power the phone off.
Right, but then it also introduces that, like, well, if this person becomes a physical threat, then I have then it's an ordeal to call 911.
Exactly.
I think about this a lot, especially with regard to hotels. Like, hotels have to cater to the lowest common denominator, mm-hmm. right? And if you have made it so that the fire department, if you have made it so that your stalker or the sketchy client you just saw can't get in, you have also made it so the fire department can't get in. And so it's like, but there just are always natural trade-offs. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're always going to be compromising either your safety for security mm-hmm. or your security for your safety yeah. or your liberty or whatever. And I guess there's a balance that one can strike, but is there just a certain level of acceptance you have to have around that?
Some degree. It's putting enough friction in those middle ground spaces, like using that little blue strap on a deadbolt, and we can put it on the door over there if you want in a second. That would stop, like, you know, Stevie the stalker, because all of a sudden their tool doesn't work. If, however, there's actually a cardiac episode happening and emergency responders are outside, like, they're going to get in. They're going to get in more noisily
right.
and with a lot more disturbance, but they're going to get in. So forcing someone who's trying to get in to go overt, to go big, to go loud, forcing that overt action would usually dissuade a person who does not legitimately belong there. It's not a simple scenario. And anybody who portrays any of these as like easily solvable problems is oversimplifying or has a huge blind spot for someone else's threat model that isn't their threat model.
Can you explain what you mean by threat model?
So, yeah, I would say this is kind of an interesting scenario where I do a lot of work with the firearms community. And you'll get a lot of people saying, well, if you need to protect your home, you need X, and everyone should just rely on blah. And I'll say, well, what is my threat model? If you live in an area where you have all these break-ins, and you really expect to be meeting something with lethal force, that's your threat model. My threat model is honestly court liability. Like, I have personal assets, my wife has personal assets, so I don't want the biggest, scariest, most custom-looking firearm, because my threat model is literally that firearm being held up as Exhibit A in a courtroom. That's why I want the most boring sporting goods store shotgun as our, like, that's our home defense gun. We have a lot of other guns. That's not the home defense gun. It's just the boring shotgun that makes me, because my threat model is literally legal ramifications. I am not likely to be threatened physically in our home. Like, we've had stalkers and all, but they're all fucking losers.
They're never gonna.
The louder your stalker, like, please, oh my God, the louder your stalker is, the less they're ever going to do anything. They're all dumbasses. But yeah, so threat modeling is the most important part of saying, what is my most likely risk? And if you're putting all of your effort into guarding against the unlikely risk, that's misapplied time and effort and money, potentially.
Yeah. Like, I'm moving into an area where home break-ins aren't terribly common, but carjackings are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're constant. And that means that the way that I go about my personal security is going to be, you know, everyone's like, oh, you're moving, you know, back to Louisiana, you need a gun. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, probably I do. And it, like, whatever. But it's like, do I need a house stocked with guns, or do I need some kind of solution for my vehicle?
And do you, again, the...
And do I feel confident using them right. in either situation?
And defending...
Or do I just need a good car alarm system?
Mm-hmm. Defending oneself with a firearm, it's, and even the most prominent, like, you're down in Louisiana, my guy James, he runs a channel called The Firearm Blog, TFB. I mean, he's a lawyer. He'll tell you, you defend yourself with a firearm, it's the equivalent of basically buying a very nice used car or a very cheap new car and just driving it off a pier. You're just going to be out about 50, 60K, just in the toilet. So maybe using a taser, like... These, again, everyone's...
Also less likely to kill yourself with it.
Yes.
Or have it be wrangled from you and you be killed with it, yeah.
Oh, yeah. They make a little civilian one. They make the little taser pulse.
Mm-hmm.
I know people who work at Axon. Because I like that... I know a lot of the hackers in the world know this. So, accountability. Axon's whole thing with their... This is kind of neat. The body cam, all the body cam stuff. Mm-hmm. Axon is... Which is Taser. They are thought of as this company that's, like, super tied to the police... And they are. I mean, their industry is very police-centric. But their whole architecture of their system and all their technology is made so that the police don't have control over that data. Everything about it, which uses encryption, it uses digital signing, it is made so that police at their department, even the custodian officers who oversee the cameras, can't tamper with the footage. They can't delete it, erase it, move it. And Axon's whole mantra is about increasing oversight and increasing accountability. Now, there's a lot we have to do in terms of local laws and open records requests, which many areas are very closed about releasing footage. But Axon's thing is like, look, we can't unfortunately control what your shitty laws are in Virginia, but we guarantee you, if you actually succeed in court, that footage is there and has not been tampered with.
That it's intact. Yeah.
So yeah, I like those cats. They, you know, when I'm in Arizona, I've taken taser exposures at Axon just to see what it was like. And it's unique. It's a unique experience.
There's almost a church and state, like becoming like a church and state sanctification of the separation between corporate and state powers in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go back and forth on this because as kind of a nanny state liberal inherently,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, we need to reform 230 in a responsible way. And we need to regulate the fuck out of like Amazon and Facebook and these guys. But then I'm also like, in the same way that I, as a systems oriented person, feel that our elections should be more centralized, I also recognize the capacity for that to have completely gone awry in, for example, this last election, right? Mm-hmm. In instances where there's corruption.
Mm-hmm.
So maintaining that balance from a regulatory perspective is really delicate and important. What do you see coming down the pike regulation wise? I mean, we're definitely at a turning point where tech and has come of age and is starting to lose the shine. Like, no one likes Zuckerberg anymore.
That's true.
The entire country of Australia is completely sick of his shit. 230's on the chopping block.
Yeah, which is scary.
It's very, very unsettling. I don't know. What do you think's going to happen? What do you see coming down the pike?
Not to be just negative Norman, but my initial reaction is always whatever changes get implemented in policy will always result in the less moneyed and less privileged interests getting squashed.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, like, let's say 230 becomes ironclad tomorrow and like they reinforce it, make it very strong. For those, of course, many of your listeners already know Section 230 is what is or isn't editing and publishing or censorship on the internet. It has to do with what content is allowed or not allowed and what responsibility websites have over their content. Section 230 is what allows Twitter to let people tweet about, let's say, their sex work because Twitter's not responsible for it. Let's say that becomes super ironclad. Some people are going to find a way, very powerful people with money, to abuse that and to squash down on, let's say, nascent liberation movements. They're going to just spam the hell out of horrible, hateful content and try to just target people who are vulnerable populations. Or if 230 gets flipped and those protections are gone, well, instantly, the same powerful people who got to act negatively and antisocially to everyone are going to keep doing that because they're insulated from any consequences. And the people who have already been squashed are just going to get squashed more. And we're going to see marginalized populations pushed even further off of mainstream platforms.
Yeah. How does that interlink with cybersecurity? Because I feel like it does in a really strong way, but I don't necessarily have the language to articulate how that works. I know, yeah. For example, with SESTA-FOSTA, you know, that's a 230 adjacent, mm-hmm. and First Amendment, but yeah. That's another issue. That's an issue for the courtroom. Adjacent law that has compromised the cybersecurity and physical security of a tremendous amount of marginalized people, including yes. sex workers.
So SESTA-FOSTA and the now Earn It Act, which is kind of the spiritual successor to all that horribleness. It's almost interesting, and I want to be very careful to not sound cavalier here because the ramifications are bad. If things pushed so far in the wrong direction, and this almost happened with SESTA-FOSTA, there could become a time when mainstream US-based hosting providers are just untenable at that point. Like, it's just so unfeasible to try anymore to use Twitter, Instagram, any of the mainstream services. Like, we saw the Mastodon interest instance spin up when SESTA-FOSTA came out, and it was cool for a while, and then it kind of, people didn't use it as much. We would almost see a mass exodus away from U.S. hosting corporations entirely. Like, literally leaving the shores of America. And that's what Assembly 4, the whole group, is doing in Australia. That's a sex work-led, basically, hosting provider. And they've been, they spun up when Sesta Fosta came out. That's, they were running the Twitter instance. They were one of the first groups to ever get denied protection by Cloudflare, which is, everyone says, oh, remember when Cloudflare finally took a stand and they kicked the Daily Stormer off the internet? Nope, that was not the first time they did it. The first one was when they actually knocked Twitter offline. So there's a lot of scramble that has to happen. And any kind of these, people love these grand revolutionary ideas. Well, this will push everyone over the edge, and in a few years, we'll have our own situation. That's great, but in those few years, like, people are starving and not making rent. Like,
right.
It's,
I mean,
a really bad time. You can't just look to the wonderful future.
Creative destruction is important for innovation and progress, but it's still destruction. Yeah.
I hope that the needle just moves back the other direction a little more, and we step back from this precipice.
Well, it seems as though regulation, and I don't know to what degree, and I wouldn't even want to speculate to what degree this is inherent in its nature, but it's very overreactive and completely lacks nuance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, like, Twitter and the Daily Storm, or, like, QAnon people and sex workers are put in the same category by the same types of regulation, to me seems absurd.
Yeah.
And I don't know to what degree that is about bureaucratic limitations and capacity to take things on a case-by-case basis, because I think about this all the time with, for example, you know, the fact that I have a family member who served 3 years for sexting as an underage person.
Oh my God.
Yes. And, and, you know, he's a sex offender who's in the same category legally as somebody who, you know, literally, like, raped a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, is the lack of nuance and the inability to case by case this stuff inherent in its nature because we live in a pluralistic society that has to cater to a lot of different needs, and one person looking at the law may think that sex workers and QAnon people or human traffickers are literally the same morally, or is it because there's systems limitations inherent in bureaucracy, or is it just because we're hyper reactive and lazy?
I think most people are at the, I hyperreactive and lazy is what is the best definition. The kinder definition is people are just burning the candle at both ends. People don't have the time to, like, read every news article and distill down all the fact from fiction. That's really,
well,
why.
I don't get laid, so I have time. You know, it's fine.
I really think that's why decrim of any kind is really whatever your niche part of life is that's getting squashed, making sure that it is at the very least legal on the books, that is not criminal. Because that, to reference all of my gun people on the internet, like, their content gets very demonetized and gets kicked off of, let's say, YouTube. But they always have one leg to stand on, which is going back to the terms of service and saying, look, nothing I'm showing is illegal. And they'll letter writing campaigns and stuff, and then people's channels get reactivated. Sex workers deserve that protection. Once literally any region, and God, we're all eyes on Oregon right now. Once any region does full decrim correctly, that's going to be an amazing moment, because people who are actually there and are publicly talking about, I do sex work, this is my blah, and if they will have one extra golf club in the bag that they can swing if someone tries to ban them from a service or kick them and say, look, I'm not doing anything illegal. I might, but maybe your terms of service need to evolve, because that might be against your terms of service. But that is a wedge that can be used against a lot of these large companies. Because if you're not doing something that is criminal, and again, criminal doesn't mean moral, doesn't mean, there's a whole separate debate,
right,
about that. About
means what, letter yes, of the yeah, law. Yeah. For
what
this
is
context.
Lawful, what is legal, what is moral, what is, etc. But it is something.
Nothing, man.
Yeah.
None of it matters.
And look at that. There's a ton of content on the internet now that's cannabis related and drug related. That if the internet existed in this form 20 years ago, would all be banned, because they would say, "Well, that's drugs. That's illegal." Any corporate entity likes to broad brush things, and muddying the waters by saying, well, it's actually not illegal. Look at these 37 states, you know. That helps a lot in moving the needle and keeping the discussion open and free.
When I think about my own security, whether it's my physical security measures or my digital security, it just seems really intimidating. Mm-hmm. And it feels like there's some big barriers to entry as far as knowledge go. Mm-hmm. Like, if you are the kind of person who has, whether it's because you're a state acting investigation, you know, investigating agency or a stalker, mm-hmm. you have a single-minded focus that drives you to acquiring that knowledge. But mm-hmm. if you're just a civilian or even just a sex worker, it's so ancillary and it feels really big, right? Yeah. It feels like there's so much capacity for you to do it wrong. It's going to be expensive. It's going to, you know, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that person?
Collections of resources that distill down knowledge in a way that it is achievable and accessible to someone who's not an expert are really important. It's why one of the things that I was really proud to work with, and the first time that presentation actually got revealed was through Pornhub, where Domcat and Lola Jean and some others put together what was basically called the Sex Worker Safety Conference. And they wanted it to be, they're actually putting up all these resources in a health and community portal where it's going to say, look, if you need to know about, there was like law, there was literally a section about family law. There was a section about medical counseling and therapy counseling, and I was talking about security. So having a one-stop shop where people cannot be obliged to spend hours and hours and hours out of their day doing do the hard work for them, distill things down in a way, and everyone bemoans how bite-sized attention span we are today, but giving people those smaller, we don't just have short attention spans, we're just busy. I'm just fucking busy. I don't have time to read 5 hours of this content. Can you summarize it for me?
And I'm not really that interested in it, right?
Yeah.
Like personally, I am not interested in like I want to dedicate 20 hours to learning it type of way in mm-hmm. cybersecurity, right?
Yeah.
But it is important and I need, well, you know, I'm not that interested, I guess, in like learning the ins and outs of my fucking homeowner's insurance policy either.
Right.
But I need to know that information.
So people who have that magic ability to distill things down, it's literally what Sarah Marshall told Michael Hobbs at the beginning of their episode on sex work.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, well, here's how it works. This is what we're here for. Michael, she's like, you probably did about 100 to 200 hours of research on this episode. And then you and I are going to talk for about 3 hours. And then we'll edit it down to about a 1 hour podcast. And then people, our listeners, can turn that into like 15 minutes of whisper shouting at Thanksgiving.
Nice. Nice. It's true.
Yeah. So being a part of that process to distill it down so people can get the important stuff, get the 80% solution and just move the fuck on with like, all right, I got to clean the cat box now.
Right, right. After I clean my digital cat box, mm-hmm. right? What would you say are like 3 to 5 of the most important things that sex workers can do for their physical and or digital security? Like,
sure.
Straight off
the
bat.
Let's do like 3 and 3 on digital and physical.
Mm-hmm.
Physical security, I would say 1, actually understand if your like front door, whether that is a hotel door or whether that is a residential door, is not susceptible to what I'll call latch slipping or what we'll call bypass attacks. Like literally, we can play with these later too. This is just a thin piece of plastic. If I can shove this into a door frame, a lot of doors will just spring open because literally the latch is not installed correctly. We're talking about just move a screw, fix that. These little red-handled hooks, same thing. That under door tool, if you're in a hotel, understand if you can either use the blue strap or worst case, like roll up a towel and shove it behind the door handle. I have that in my presentation. Like get the low end bypassing stuff out of the way. That's number 1 for physical. Number 2 for physical would effectively be beyond the most low hanging and bypasses, do a little bit of a threat assessment of your life and say, where are my risks? Actually meaningfully say, is my genuine risk that law enforcement is going to come in? Or is my genuine risk that a disgruntled person who I used to know is going to try to find me? Is my risk that my, you know, family, maybe if you have all this physical posture, if you start building up a crazy postured up house, does that just mean your family and neighbors and your relations start asking questions they shouldn't ask? Like, which is the real risk? So doing a little bit of a risk thought process in your head.
Right. You don't need to go crazy. You need to figure out what's important to you, like what your priorities are.
And the last one for physical is monitoring and reconstruction. We didn't talk much about cameras. Well, you and I did talk about cameras because I said, just so you know, you're going to see cameras outside when you pull up. I like to tell people. And that's, you know, we have cameras because my wife and I have had crazy stalkers over the years. And understanding the limits of those cameras, understanding, do they actually work? Do the alerts come to you correctly? If you're in a hotel, like, here you go, I'll pass you this. What does that look like?
It looks like a wall unit for a iPhone or whatever.
Yeah, it's a phone, and it is. It's a working phone charger. You know what else it is? It's a camera.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Ah, I see the little...
Yeah. So if I peel this back panel off, there's an SD card and everything in there. So if I if I'm in a hotel and I go out and I want to know, was anyone in my room when I was out?
Oh my God. Yeah,
there's an SD card.
Awesome.
I can dump that SD card. Or there's newer. I mean, this is old. This is a couple years old. You can get ones now that'll literally message your phone while you are away. And
my brother got a security system on his new house, and my friend and I were going over there to do some, feed their cats or something. And I knew that he had this capability, but my friend didn't. So we're standing in the yard, we're having a cigarette, and my brother, who has it hooked up to his phone, is over at my parents' house, and he goes, "What are you doing?" Scared the absolute shit out of my friend.
Yeah.
That's hilarious, but it's amazing what they can do now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, get your main front doors just not bypassable.
Mm-hmm.
Understand what, start to then really think about your threats, and then potentially invest in some sort of monitoring solution that, if you're not home and, you know, that crazy ex does come around, at least you knew about it. And you can adjust your behavior that way.
I mean, there's not really limits to what you can save now because of digital technology.
Oh, yeah.
I have a friend who is a diabetic, and she has what's called a continuous monitoring device.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, it's a needle, and it's got a little thing on it, a little monitor on it, and it sends her blood sugar to her phone and her doctor continuously. And they're, you know, they can keep that data to look at trends over time. They can wipe it out after 30 days, because after 30 days it becomes not relevant. Like,
mm-hmm.
I think a thing that I always think of is, like, every convenience store in a murder or a robbery, they have a camera that doesn't work, or they have a camera that re-records every 24 hours or whatever. And it's like, I'm sure there are systems out there that have really good, sensible, don't take up a ton of cloud space.
Mm-hmm. And that, again, this, now we're getting into the digital side, mm-hmm. might as well, because now it's the next three. I mean, those cameras, that's a perfect segue, because something like Nest, you know, we happen to use, you know, Nest at one of our buildings, but it's not what I recommend to a lot of people, because you're giving your data to Google. Google has shown themselves to be very willing to work with law enforcement with no warrant. And they'll just say, oh, you want to see what someone's Nest cam was? Here you go. Compare that to something. You were talking about, like, NordVPN got a bunch of podcast, you know, exposure. Another company that did a lot of podcast exposure and YouTube exposure was called Ubiquiti. Ubiquiti is a home camera solution, much more expensive than Nest, but that's because you're not the product. The product is what you're buying, and you own all the data, and it lives locally. It's not being shared with Google. So these are all questions that you get into. But on the digital side...
What about Alexa? What is the deal with all that?
Alexa's Amazon. Alexa's trash. I mean, no, like, again, this is... It depends on what your threat model is.
That's true.
If you literally are the most boring Republican Rotarian who has no social life, and you just want to be able to be like, Alexa, order more gin. Like, the friction-free experience, there's a reason it exists in the marketplace. But Alexa is, like, literally is listening at all times. And Amazon is another company that has shown themselves very willing to work with law enforcement, oftentimes in the absence of a warrant. And law enforcement will say, well, tell me what's happening in that person's kitchen right now. I have no evidence of this. We do have evidence of things like vacuum robots, right? So, like, vacuum robots, when they go around your floor, they make a little map of the house, right? So they bump into things and fall down the stairs. There is on the books case law at this point of law enforcement asking for those records from who the hell's the iRobot? Who makes the Christ? Roomba. Roomba.
I can just imagine a Roomba picking up like a little tiny bit of cocaine from your New Year's party in your cleanup and then like alerting law enforcement.
Well, there's law enforcement that were planning raids on people's homes, which, again, if you haven't seen the John Oliver episode about raids, it's a fucking national tragedy. But they would say to Roomba, to iRobot, they'd say, give us someone's blueprints of their home as far as the Roomba is concerned. And they would just give them to them. So anytime we do things digitally in the cloud, that's a whole other mess, which is beyond the scope of my top three that I will say here. The top three.
We're going to have a follow-up conversation about that, I expect.
So the top three just for digital hygiene. One is get a mobile device that is business only. If you have the economic means, again, smartphones are hundreds of dollars, and I recognize not just everyone can do that. Get a mobile device that is business only, and that literally means business only, which is a shame because a lot of people, I understand, like social media, if you're connecting, like if a sex worker is DMing another sex worker, well, is that like business or is that pleasure? Is that their social account? So there's a lot of gray area in this. It sucks. But your Proton Mail account, your Signal number, like that is work. And only use it for work. Don't use it for coordinating, hey, we're going out to the karaoke tonight, or hey, are you coming to the airport to pick me up if it's social? Get a device that is 100% work. Point number two is make sure you are using the absolute up-to-date security, just manufacturer security on that device. Is it the latest iPhone or Android? Is it running the latest, you know, patches and updates? Are you keeping it locked at all times with a long, doesn't have to be super crazy characters, but a long password? So first is A, is you got a device that's just for work. Great. Point B is now use the device to its best stock settings at the very least. And then C, getting into something that's not just your device, a third party product, which would be using widely accepted and widely recommended security software. And the first A number one there is a password manager. Using a password manager with that very long password, then you can get into something like maybe use Signal for messaging instead of just texting. You know, use Proton Mail instead of regular Gmail. But that's really, you know, get a device that's just for work, make sure it's fully updated and using a long password, know how to turn it off or turn off biometrics if you're in a dodgy situation. And then use a password manager and get into some other devices that hackers love to crow about all the time on Twitter, like things like Signal, things like Proton Mail.
Give me your socials, your websites, all the stuff. Give me whatever you want out there.
So anyone looking for me on the internet, I am Deviant Olaf, which is not spelled remotely the way it sounds. Deviant spelled the way you think, but Olaf is O-L-L-A-M. It is Celtic. And if you pronounce it correctly the first time you meet me, I will be impressed, because most folk don't. It's my own little shibboleth. But yes, I am that. I am that on Twitter, on Instagram, on YouTube, on, you know, GitHub and other places. But if you search, honestly, just if you search deviant lockpicking or deviant physical security or deviant elevator hacking, all the results will pretty much be me on a stage somewhere talking about this stuff to an audience who can't believe it.
Today's episode was produced by me, Blair Hopkins, and brought to you in part by Swap Behind Bars. Music by New Orleans' own Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Check them out at johnnysketch.com. Special thanks, as always, to Alex Andrews. To contribute to the good work she's doing with Swap Behind Bars, visit swapbehindbars.org. And remember, All in a Day's Sex Work is an ever-expanding narrative. If you are a sex worker, partner, patron, or other adult industry-adjacent person, I want to hear from you. Email me at info@adswproject.org.